Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We're your hosts, Vincent Hannum
and Matt Levine.
And we're talking about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts, welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by BanditsEmporium.com, where you can shop exclusive monster-inspired t-shirts with a part of the proceeds supporting this show. BanditsEmporium.com, hit the link in our bio. As they say, we sell shirts. As Camp Kaiju says, stay campy, everybody. And hey, Matt, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Vincent. It's been so long.
So long. So excited. So Matt and I are just coming off our discussion of Wolf. So if you haven't checked out that episode, please do so. Catch the movie too. Honestly, if you love talking about movies and truly the good, the bad, and the campy, Wolf fits the bill, wouldn't you say?
It has all the above, yeah. Maybe more of the bad category, but certainly some good, definitely some campy. It's all there.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, a lot of people might say that about Godzilla versus King Ghidorah. So thank you, friends, for hanging out. Please rate and review wherever you listen to this podcast. Also, go ahead and share this podcast with a friend. You know they are going to like it. Check out CampKaijuMovieReviews.com and or Patreon.com/CampKaiju for more reviews and special content. And for our special patrons, you know who you are. Jason, Chris, Frank, Kelly, Peggy, and our anonymous awesome supporters. We got a gong to hit for you. So Matt, will you please hand me the gong mallet?
But of course, here you go, my friend.
Thank you. Oh, this is, I need to work out. This is getting heavier than I'm used to. Okay. And a one. And a two. And a...
Whoa.
Nailed it.
Yeah, you did. MVP gonger, Vincent Hannum. You gonger, you.
Put that on a bumper sticker. MVP gonger.
I guess it should be MVG, most valuable gonger. That makes more sense.
Oh, Gamera. The power of Gamera was strong with me in that one.
It was. It was indeed.
Speaking of Gamera, we got to bring another Gamera film to the podcast in the second half of 2023. So our longtime listeners, as you know, Matt and I selected 12 films for this first half of season three. The second half of season three is going to hit you July through December. So stay tuned. Matt and I are going to concoct some pretty varied titles there and share them with you probably in July. Matt, what do we have coming up on the podcast that we know of?
Let's see. Coming up soon, we have The Blob from 1958. So that's the original one, of course. And then we also have Porco Rosso by Hayao Miyazaki from 1992. Both of those episodes should have special guest stars. Gary Danciu and perhaps The Blob itself will be joining us to talk about The Blob.
You know, The Blob came into my office just this morning, squishing and gliding across the floor and doing its best blob speak, just begging to get onto this show. And I told him, I was like, Blob, I got to talk to Matt about this. we can't have you really realistically on a Godzilla versus King Ghidorah episode.
No, not on this episode for sure, but on, you know, the episode featuring the blob itself, how can we say no? I don't want to be liquefied by the blob, so I think we kind of have to.
Who does? I mean, he's a nice guy, but at the end of the day, cold-blooded killer.
Yeah. He doesn't even mean to sometimes, you know? You get caught up and it's wow, man, I wish I remembered the theme song right now. It rolls, it squishes, I can't remember how it goes.
It glides, it slides. No, it,
The blob would be so mad if it hurt us right now.
God, yeah, seriously, keep it to yourselves. And all you out there, kaiju campers. Oh no. I told him no to this episode. Sorry, one second. Yeah, hey Blob, we're in the middle of something here. Yeah, recording an episode. No, I told you next time. Hey, don't get mad at me. Alright, we know the song. I promise you we know the song. And I know, trust me, I know what you can do to my flesh and bones. But listen to me. Blobby, baby, I love you. We love to see you. But next week, okay? Yep, same time, same place. Next week, okay? Alright, we'll see you later. Okay. Bye-bye. Yes, yes, Paula will validate. Just show her the ticket. Sorry about that. Where were we?
Yeah, and I do just want to add that Frank Olson will be joining us for Porco Rosso. So stay tuned for that as well. It's going to be great. I've never seen that movie, but I'm really, really excited to talk about it here.
Agreed. Another animated film. And our Luca episode, everyone loved that episode. It's one of our most downloaded pieces of content on Camp Kaiju. So, yeah, let's bring in some animated monsters for sure.
I would love that, yeah.
All right. Matt, what's your personal history with Godzilla versus King Ghidorah?
I did not really have any history with this movie at all. I was excited to check it out, though, because I really liked the other two Heisei-era Godzilla movies that I've seen, which is The Return of Godzilla from 1984 and Godzilla vs. Biollante, which is from 1989, I'm pretty sure. And this one, like, I didn't really know what to expect going into it. I really love Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, which is probably my second favorite kaiju movie after the original Godzilla. So I had high expectations, high hopes. But even with those expectations, I was kind of blown away. I really like this movie a lot.
I'm so glad to hear that. This is one of those movies. First of all, I only saw it myself for the first time in 2019, so only 4 years ago. But I absolutely loved it. I immediately called Gary Dansu and said, because he'd never seen any Godzilla movies, really. And I said, you got to watch this one and Godzilla versus Mothra, or Mothra versus Godzilla. But that just shows like how much I love Godzilla versus King Ghidorah. It's on my short list. I think it's a must see. Wait. There's got to be some bad things. I'll get to them. But yeah, I just like this movie a lot. I think it's got a lot to offer for fans of the genre.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very weird. The plot's all over the place in a good way, I think. There are some very surprising, unexpected themes, like really dealing with like Japan's place in like the global community or whatever. So yeah, it's great. I loved it.
So this movie starts off with a bang, and we have these people called the Futurians, and they are time travelers from the 23rd century. They arrive in Japan in 1992 to warn the Japanese of the nation's destruction under Godzilla in the 23rd century. They offer to help erase Godzilla from history by preventing his creation from the H-bomb testing at Lagos Island in the South Pacific. So to do this, the Futurians lead a team to 1944 to Lagos Island, where a dinosaur is living unbeknownst to the world. But what's happening in 1944 in the South Pacific? World War II. So this island and a garrison of Japanese soldiers are currently under attack from the American Navy. This dinosaur saves the Japanese garrison from the Americans, but then is shot at itself by some U.S. battleships and seemingly dies. The Futurians then teleport this Godzilla dinosaur to the bottom of the ocean.
However, the Futurians have an ulterior motive. At the same time, they covertly release three Ghidorah-like minions onto the island. I believe those minions are called Dorats, and they are awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So It is now those three creatures that are radioactively transformed into a kaiju beast from the H-bomb testing in 1954. So they, in other words, fuse together and become King Ghidorah. Back in 1992, with Godzilla gone and replaced with the evil King Ghidorah, the Futurians' true intentions are revealed. The destruction of Japan, to prevent it from becoming the dominant power in the 23rd century.
Yeah, so we are shifting through more than two time periods even in this film.
This movie will give you whiplash with the number of like flashbacks and flash forwards that it has. Like, we start off in 2204, then go back to 92, then 44, 92. There's some like other time travel that we don't see on screen. We're all over the place here. It's crazy.
Yeah, and already it's standing apart from any other Godzilla movie, just with the addition of time travel. And I didn't even realize this when I first picked the movie. Following the Valley of Gwangi, we have another kind of dinosaur movie as well. So it's just a wonderful mishmash of genres, I feel like. You got UFOs, time travel, dinosaurs, kaiju, you name it.
Yeah, somehow I think it all works. Like, I think the plot is really overstuffed. It's very preposterous, but like that just kind of keeps you on your toes, and it's such a good way to like deliver the themes of the movie that it doesn't really seem like it's like sloppy or anything. Like it all seems like pretty well calibrated, you know?
Yeah, totally. So in this film we have a large cast and crew, a lot of familiar faces. We have Kosuke Toyohara as Konichira Terasawa, and this actor is returning from Godzilla vs. Biollante. We have Katsuhiko Sasaki as Professor Hironori Mizaki, and Love Sasaki, he is from the previous Godzilla vs. Megalon and the final film of the Showa era, Terror of Mechagodzilla. So he's much older here, a nice familiar face. And Matt, are you familiar with Yoshiro Tsuchiya?
Somewhat. I've seen many of the movies that he's been in throughout his career. You know, a lot of, you know, classics of Japanese cinema. He appeared in Funeral Parade of Roses by Toshio Matsumoto, a really fantastic movie from the Japanese New Wave. It's kind of a transgender adaptation of Oedipus Rex. Really fascinating movie. Yoshio Tsuchiya also starred in Seven Samurai and Red Beard, both by Akira Kurosawa, as well as the movie Kill by Kihachi Okamoto. This actor had a long-standing interest in UFOs and wrote several books about the topic. He really enjoyed starring in science fiction films, usually as aliens or people possessed by them, in films such as Battle in Outer Space, Monster Zero, and Destroy All Monsters.
I love that, that this man who is in some of the most highly regarded films, working with Akira Kurosawa and others, and at the end of the day, he just wants to be in science fiction movies.
It just goes like, you know, I feel like maybe in Japanese cinema, there's less of like a distinction between like, oh, this is like important art cinema and this is like lowbrow genre cinema or whatever. Like, I feel like in Japan, like, it all kind of mixes together, and, you know, great art films can have a lot of visceral excitement, and these kind of much maligned genre movies in other countries carry a lot of like thematic weight and can be really innovative in themselves, you know?
Yeah, and I read another thing about Tsuchiya. He is in Ishiro Honda's The Mysterians from 1957, thereabouts. And The Mysterians, he's an alien and he wears a mask over his face. So his face is covered. And he was asked, is this okay? And he said, yeah, I just, as long as I get to play an alien. So yeah, just no ego, no, seemingly no ego there. I love it.
I can only imagine how much fun these movies would be to act in, you know, like, you know, you certainly are playing a character and you take your job seriously, but there's just like so much mayhem and imagination and like fun special effects going on. It's, you know, certainly for the audience, that's the case. And I'm sure it's true for the actors as well, you know?
Yeah. Do you mind if I go on a brief tangent if I bring something up?
Not at all.
I recently watched, I don't know if I talked to you about this, Tokyo Story by Yasujiro Ozu.
Highly acclaimed movie, one of the best ever, perhaps.
I fell in love with it. It was just so pure and simple and devastating and hilarious. It was just all of it.
Yeah, for sure. Ozu is one of the best. He has an older movie from 32 called I Was Born But... dot dot dot, which is maybe my second favorite by him. Late Spring from, I think, 46 is fantastic as well. I think there are not many other directors in the history of cinema that are able to convey the vastness of human experience so powerfully. It seems understated, and yet, like, before you even realize it, the emotional impact of his movies just, like, really hit you full force. He's amazing.
That's what Tokyo Story did to me. It's just, like, you see so many movies that try to just be slice of life family dramas, and they come off maybe a little overwrought, maybe a little melodramatic. But Tokyo Story was just so confident in being so seemingly simple that it just hits you right in the gut.
Absolutely. Like, he's a director where it becomes clear that he knows exactly what he's doing. Every single frame, every edit, like every performance, like, it is perfectly directed. It's one of the best directed movies that I've ever seen, you know?
100%. Yeah. Woo! Everyone out there, when you like, there's a million movies out there. We've all seen a million movies, but when you see one that is perfectly executed with true artistic intent, it's just, you just know when you see it and it blows your socks off. All right. Let's get back to Godzilla versus King Ghidorah.
I didn't expect to talk about Ozu tonight. I love it. He's one of the best. It's a pleasant surprise.
Well, Godzilla versus King Ghidorah is pretty high up there too, right? Let's see. We have Robert Scott Field as M11. He is an android and from the future. He's one of the Futurians. Future. Anna Nakagawa, another Futurian. She plays Emi Kano. She is a Japanese national. Whereas M11, Granchico and Wilson, Richard Berger and Chuck Wilson, respectively, those are three Futurians who present as Western, maybe even American, whereas Anna Nakagawa as Emi Kano is, as she says, a Japanese national. So there's some good dichotomy there, some good, maybe a little tension between the four Futurians. We have Megumi Odaka as Miki Sagusa. She is returning again from her other appearances in the Heisei era. And Matt, as we continue this journey through the Heisei era, she's a reoccurring character. She plays an integral role to the overarching story of the Heisei era.
Yeah, so correct me if I'm wrong, but is she the same character in Godzilla versus Biollante who has kind of like a psychic rapport with Godzilla?
Yes.
Touched on in this movie as well.
Mm-hmm.
I love that storyline, which is, as far as I know, never fully explained, right? Like, it's kind of just she knows the monster so well that they have this, like, telepathic communication. I love it in Biollante, and it works really well here, too, I think, although it's a little bit more, like, not a major part of the story in this case.
And then rounding out the main cast, I would say, is Kenji Sahara. You know him, you love him. He's playing Takayuki Sagawa, and So Yamamura as the Prime Minister.
And I just want to say it's cool to see Yoshio Tsuchiya in this movie as Shindo, because Shindo is kind of like, you know, in the flashbacks, he's like one of the first characters who meets the dinosaur that becomes Godzilla. So in a way, like, you know, he's this character of Shindo is like taking us back to the very origins of Godzilla. It's a very cool plot point in this movie.
Yeah, and Shindo's relationship with Godzilla has to be the true dramatic stakes of the film. And where the true, it's such a complicated relationship between him and Godzilla, and by extension, Japan and Godzilla, that we'll get to with the themes, but it's not simple.
And it's pretty emotional too. Like,
yeah.
I would not have expected that, like, a tearful look of like love and understanding between a man and Godzilla would like be emotionally effective, but it is in this movie.
And that's what drew, that's why I keep coming back to this movie, because it offers the absurd science fiction and fantasy. But when it gets dramatic, it really gets dramatic in a really sincere way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Inadvertently, we have gone through the Heisei era in order.
I realized that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because like I you know, after watching this one, I was like, man, I think I really like the Heisei movies that I've seen. And like, yeah, it made me realize that Return of Godzilla, Godzilla versus Biollante, and then this one, I think we have to continue the timeline, right?
I think we have to go in order at this point. It would be dumb if we didn't.
Indeed. Yeah. And I know that there are more Gamera and Mothra movies from this era as well. So we have our work cut out for us.
It was a good time for Japanese kaiju movies.
I don't, you know, like until this, like doing this podcast with you, I never really realized that. I thought that like the heyday of kaiju movies were like the 50s and 60s, the original Godzilla movies. And I am only starting to realize how incorrect I was in that assumption.
Well, no, I think most of us are with you because we didn't have access to these movies in the United States. So now it's like, oh, you were holding out on us, international distributors.
We're, you know, belatedly like exposing this like wealth of treasure that's available to us now. It's great.
Thanks to technology. But man, yeah, some good stuff from this era.
Yeah.
So I bring that up because although the previously filmed Godzilla versus Biollante was and is critically acclaimed, it was not a financial blockbuster. So that led the producers at Toho to kind of go back to basics and say, okay, for our next installment, let's bring back some classic villains for Godzilla to fight. Hence King Ghidorah. I think there were plans for a Godzilla versus Mothra story that didn't work out. That would come, but for now they settled with King Ghidorah.
Yeah, and he might be my favorite monster of any of these kaiju movies. So I personally am very happy they went with Ghidorah for this one.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about Mecha King Ghidorah?
I like it. I did not really expect it. I think like the backstory where like Godzilla, like I'm getting ahead of us a little bit, explodes the middle head. So like you know, when Mecha Ghidorah comes back, he has like the metallic head in the middle, which is the one that Emmy is piloting, right? She's like in the seat or whatever, in the cockpit, like controlling Mecha Ghidorah. It's fun. I love it. Yeah. The one and only composer, Akira Ufukube, one of the best ever, agreed to compose the film score at the insistence of his daughter. He was dissatisfied with the way his compositions had been treated in Godzilla versus Biollante. So he came back for this film. I believe it was the first Godzilla score that he had done since Terror of Mechagodzilla in 1975. So there was almost a 20-year interim before he came back to work in another Godzilla film.
But he did do Biollante?
I believe, if I remember right, I did. I was reading up on this today. Biollante used some like previous compositions that he had done,
sure,
but like without his consent, and he didn't like score any new work for it.
Okay.
So this was the first time he had like worked on a new soundtrack for a Godzilla movie since 1975.
Okay. So yeah, Ufukube is back in a big way. I also do want to shout out the director Kazuki Omori, who also wrote the movie, and I think it's so nice to have a touch in Ufukube. That sort of classic Godzilla theme is so memorable. And he does some new things with it too.
Definitely, yeah. And it takes a while to like be introduced to Godzilla in this movie. Like we actually don't really see any kaiju monsters for like, I want to say at least half an hour. I don't know exactly how long. But then like when we finally do, like the classic Godzilla score like emerges all of a sudden. And it's like such a beautiful moment. I love it.
That's true about the timeline, though. I did make note, literally in the first 20 minutes, we got UFOs, World War II, dinosaurs. There's a mystery about like who these people are and time travel. 20 minutes. And then 30 minutes, maybe you start to see your first kaiju, which is the dinosaur. But it doesn't seem slow at all.
Right, I agree. Like, you know, in some of the Godzilla movies, maybe the human characters and stories are not terribly interesting. But here, like, you really have no idea what's going on. There's all the time travel stuff. There's also the Shindo character where, like, the first time we see him, he's like on a megaphone, like talking about dinosaurs and like warning other Japanese people that, like, you may think you're safe, but you're not. Danger's right around the corner. Like, there's so much cool stuff and like unexpected plot points leading up to the final, or like, you know, eventual appearance of Godzilla and King Ghidorah, that it's not boring at all. Like, you're totally absorbed in the plot until that happens.
Yeah. So the director of Mori, he himself blamed the lackluster performance of Godzilla versus Biollante on competition with Back to the Future 2, which is very interesting, which might explain such a heavy emphasis on time travel, even to the point, I don't know how many ways you can show a digital clock for the year, the day and the month. I mean, right, there are probably only so many ways, but it seemed like the Futurians took their time travel clock straight out of the DeLorean.
That's a good point. Yeah, you're right. Steal from the best, you know?
Well, this movie does steal a lot, actually, from a lot of movies that I think works a lot and then is just kind of eye rolling too.
Interesting. I'm sure we'll get more into that later. I like, one of the things I admire about this movie is that it does seem to lift plot devices and like general storylines from other movies like Back to the Future Part 2. But then, like, what it does with them is so unique and so Japanese. Like, it's so closely focused on like Japan's role again in like the global community and like it's the history of Japan as well as like where it could go in the future, that even if it seems like a little bit of like a rip off at certain times at first, like then it goes in like a wildly different direction that you didn't see coming. So, you know, I mean, like it doesn't actually seem very like stale or you know, lazy to me. Like, they really do their own thing with this movie.
That's true. That's true. So the film was released in December of 1991 in Japan, not in the United States. There was some controversy with the film, however, regarding the United States' reception to this film. So I don't know, Matt. Like, what do you think about this? So the film was considered controversial at the time of its release, being contemporary to a period of economic tension between America and Japan. And mostly due to its fictional portrayal of World War II. In the film, when they go back to 1944 to Lagos Island, what's called the Godzillasaurus kills a bunch of Americans and the Japanese are saved. Now, in my estimation, like, it's not done disrespectful to the United States. It's just a war. It's like a war movie at that point. And I'm not buying that anti-American sentiment.
I think it's really overblown into like, I don't know. Yeah, I agree with you that I don't think it's anti-American. I think that like ultimately, like the plot of the movie says that the Futurians are going back in time to destroy Japan because Japan becomes this economic superpower, this kind of like neo-imperialist, you know, much like the United States itself, country that's like overtaking other parts of the world in Africa and South America. And that's why the Futurians go back to destroy Japan because it becomes too powerful, basically. So I think that's really brilliant. I think it's, you know, I think it's saying that Japan could play this role, which is often associated with the United States, if it kind of continues down this path of like economic development at the cost of everything else. So if it is anti-American, it's also anti-Japanese. But I think like the prefix anti doesn't, it's not relevant. Like, I think it's just saying, like, you know, every country has a role in global capitalism to kind of do the right thing, to not sort of overstep its bounds, to not become too powerful at the expense of the rest of the world, you know? So I think like the political commentary in this movie is extremely complicated, and I think it touches a lot on like, you know, the post-war economic miracle in Japan, as well as the United States and like its role in kind of like leading or sort of spreading global capitalism or whatever, you know. I think like this movie is really remarkable in the ways that it, like the ways that the United States is often criticized on like the modern global political and economic stage. Again, the movie is saying Japan could be accused of this too, especially if it kind of keeps on going in this direction. The last thing I'll say on this, well, maybe not the last thing, but one more thing is that, like, you know, I mean, the United States dropped an atomic bomb, obviously, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So if this movie is anti-American, I'm like, okay, fair. Like, please be anti-American. Like, if this movie in like a fantasy sort of sci-fi way is like re-envisioning World War II or sort of like adding a new wrinkle to it, where like this most Japanese monster of Godzilla is kind of like taking its vengeance against the American Navy, I kind of love that. And I again, I don't think it is anti-American, but like I think it's kind of just a fantasy where, you know, the past is being rewritten and the future is being sort of like mulled over or like envisioned in a certain way, like what might happen in the future, you know, in like really exciting, funny ways that it does not seem to like denigrate a country. It seems to sort of like warn us about a way of thinking, you know.
Yes. Woo.
Might have been a little rambling, but that's what I love about this movie so much. Like, it's so complicated.
Yeah, I think whoever drummed up this anti-American thing was just trying to get a headline. It's shot like a war movie, which is really again, one more genre thrown into this picture. Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah is a Japanese movie. So heaven forbid they depict, they don't even call it World War II. It's called the Pacific War in Japan. So, of course, they're gonna depict their history the way they want to.
Right. I mean, there's just such a long history of American movies, whether they're war movies or otherwise, that are sort of, you know, exoticize other countries or sort of just are blatantly offensive and sort of, you know, simplifying other cultures or whatever. I like the criticism just doesn't make any sense to me because it actually seems pretty Anglo-centric to say that American movies can do whatever they want, but then a Japanese movie can't, like, in this sort of fun, again, sci-fi, visceral, exciting, humorous way, kind of do a little bit of the same thing. It makes no sense to me, you know?
No. Shout out, you out there listening. What's your take on it? Would love to hear your thoughts. So, before we get into any more good conversations, we got to tell you about our friends at BanditsEmporium.com, the official t-shirt partner of Camp Kaiju. Check out BanditsEmporium.com or hit the link in our bio to check out their selection of monster-inspired tees. Part of the proceeds goes to supporting this very show. Visit BanditsEmporium.com. Whatever your style, they have you covered. As they say, we sell shirts. And as Camp Kaiju says,
Take that, you dinosaur.
yeah, oh yeah. They have the machine gun. Take that, you dinosaur.
Right, the American Navy, yeah, is like destroying God's or the dinosaur that becomes Godzilla, and then like the one there's an American soldier who just says, "Take that, you dinosaur," after like the dinosaur collapses or whatever. It's really silly and campy and hilarious. I love it.
So this movie with the white actors is so interesting because the Futurians, I feel like, are the best actors. Are they're the best white actors I've seen so far in a Godzilla movie. But then in the flashback, all the American actors, the Navy soldiers, they are as bad as can be. They don't know how to act.
There's another line shortly before "Take that, you dinosaur," where one of the American sailors says, "It's a dinosaur. A giant dinosaur is attacking our boys." And I think that's like the second best line in the movie. To prove your point about very bad white actors in these movies, like that whole scene is really, really entertaining.
So good though. It's so cheesy. That's the word. So themes for this movie, we can let's roll up our sleeves and get into it a little bit.
Well, I suppose I already kind of went on my rant about like, you know, equating Japan with like the economic superpower of the United States. I also think there's kind of a brilliant sort of satirical theme in this movie where like, you know, the dinosaur is transplanted to the ocean floor near the Bering Strait for the express purpose of like not turning it into Godzilla because there won't be any nuclear radiation there. But then there's a like a Soviet submarine that does still irradiate the dinosaur and turns it into Godzilla anyways. So as one of the characters says in the movie, like it doesn't really matter where you go on the globe now, like there will be nuclear radiation, like you sort of can't really escape it, you know? So I think that's a pretty darkly funny way to like warn the audience about just how pervasive the negative effects of nuclear proliferation has become, you know?
I was also taken by the idea of sort of the morality. So the Futurians, at least before we know that they're evil, they're going back in time to destroy Godzilla. And whatever their intentions, the people of Japan in 1992 are on board with this. The prime minister and everyone, they're like, okay, yes, let's save Japan by destroying Godzilla in 1944. And I find the morality of that interesting. If you go back in time to change the past, even for noble intentions, should you do that? Question for the class.
Yeah, it is a really interesting theme because, you know, by this point, by 1992, like Godzilla, you know, it was a hero, right? Like a folk hero in Japan and probably throughout the world, but certainly in Japan, like the movies themselves had like portrayed Godzilla as a hero dating back to like probably the early 60s, right? Mid 60s. So, you know, to say like we need to get rid of this creature, this monster who has like caused such destruction and will do so in the future, but, you know, has become like a beloved folk hero or whatever. Like, I also think that's very intentional and really complicated because it's asking the exact question that you're asking. Like, sure, Godzilla causes all this destruction and maybe leads to a lot more nuclear pollution, but it kind of is also protecting the Japanese people and is like, you know, is a victim at the same time. It's a victim of the American Navy's nuclear testing. So, yeah, I mean, it's just a fascinating moral question. There's not an easy answer to it. I think it kind of goes back to the original Godzilla and the weapon that they create, which is, I wish I remembered more about it, but it's like an atomizer, right?
The oxygen destroyer.
Yeah. So, you know, that movie is asking, like, is it worth it to, like, destroy this super destructive villainous creature to use this weapon that could do way more harm than good, you know? I mean, I think this question is kind of related in a way. Like, maybe your intentions are good, but, like, you could seriously, like, screw up history and the future all around the world if you try to do this. So, you know, I think, you know, not meddling with time travel seems like a pretty safe conclusion to come to. But yeah, these are like the kind of interesting questions that these movies ask in sort of just a fun, silly sci-fi surface, you know?
Yeah. And then when King Ghidorah shows up, everyone's like, oh, well, I wish we had Godzilla now.
Right. Yeah. And then, of course, he shows up anyway. So,
yeah. Yeah. But for a time, they're like, was it worth it?
Yeah, it's, you know, I there are a lot of reasons that I like this movie, which is probably obvious by now. But I think, like, it's really interrogating, like, the myth of Godzilla and, like, what it means to Japan, like, the Japanese people and culture as a whole. And, you know, I can't think of too many other Godzilla movies that I've seen so far that, like, confront that cultural heritage so directly, you know?
And it's so well played in Shindo, the character. His final moment, he before his death, at the hands of Godzilla, he is sharing this moment, this like eye-to-eye moment with Godzilla, this creature who saved his life in 1944 and now is going to end his life in 1992. And he knows this, he accepts it, but there's like a willingness, there's an understanding of life and death all wrapped up in this one creature, a god. Literally, I think this is where the godlike nature of Godzilla comes into play, where at times a destroyer, other times a savior. And what do you do with that as a human being?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, I think like metaphorically it works too, because it's sort of like, this is the future that Japan has created for itself in a way. And what I mean by that is like, there's actually a line of dialogue that says that Godzilla, or the dinosaur on Lagos Island, I'm just going to call the dinosaur Godzilla. It's easier that way. So, but like, you know, so Godzilla like saves all these Japanese soldiers. And there's even a line of dialogue that specifically says, those are the soldiers that created Japan's economic miracle that led to Japan's wealth later on, you know, throughout the 20th century. So Godzilla didn't just save those soldiers. It kind of saved the country as a whole because it paved the way for the country to be like a very major player on like the international capitalistic, you know, machine or network or whatever you want to call it. So in a way, you know, for Godzilla to like save Shindo so many years ago and then to be his downfall later on, you know, metaphorically it can be read that like Godzilla, you know, helps Japan become like this global economic superpower, but that could be the country's downfall in the long run as well. It's like metaphorically, it's again, I'll use the word complicated. It's really thought-provoking.
Yeah, and in the film, Japan in the 23rd century becomes the strongest country in the world. And who decides that that can't happen? The Futurians, who present as white Western people. And again, it's just like tapping into the historical relationship of Japan with the Western powers. Hey, Professor Hannum is back here. History lesson again. Japan fought on the side of the Allies in World War I. Japan's goal was to be on the equal playing field as the European and United States powers. Great. After World War I, the Europeans and the United States said, "Thanks, but we're still not going to give you all the territory that you deserve from your conquests of Germany in that war," because Germany had a lot of South Pacific islands, and Japan was like, "Hey, those are ours now." And Britain and France and the United States was like, "No." And it's just that like keeping in down because they're not white. Hence World War II, Japan trying to assert itself, going to war with the Western powers. And I guess in the 23rd century, it happens again.
It's the one constant throughout all of human history, apparently. I feel like it's really fascinating that it's also a constant throughout most of the Godzilla movies that I've seen. Like, you know, Shin Godzilla, which is pretty recent, 2016, I think. That's like a big theme of that movie too, that Japan feels like pressured to ally with the United States in order to like, you know, vanquish this monster that's destroying the country. But you know, they don't want to. They don't want to rely on like this, you know, economic and military superpower. But that's just kind of like the situation that you know, that the world finds itself in. And you know, like I guess I don't really know where I'm going with this. I'm sorry. Just like confronting the fact that like the United States like occupies this role, and it's not really a good thing, but like it's probably past the point of no return now, you know?
Well, totally. And I think in Shin Godzilla, but also we see it in some of Ishiro Honda's works too, like with Mothra and that critique of America being the protector of Japan, the constitutionally designated protector. Japan doesn't have nuclear arms. We do, in case China were to come in, North Korea. We're the big guns for Japan. And I think there's a lot of people in Japan. I think I'm not going to speak for people of Japan who resist that. And I think you could see that throughout Godzilla films from the 60s to Shin Godzilla.
Totally, yeah. And I think that comes up in this movie as well, in Godzilla versus King Ghidorah, because one of the Japanese politicians says that they actually do have a nuclear weapon. It's kind of like kept from the public. Nobody really knows about it, but like that's the weapon that they're trying to use to like irradiate the dinosaur to become Godzilla again. And you know, like another character is like very upset about this and like, you know, is like, oh, like how dare you like hide this nuclear weapon from the Japanese people? We shouldn't be doing this. But at the same time, like, yeah, having a nuclear weapon allows Japan to play at the same level as the United States or Russia or the Soviet Union at this time. Actually, I guess it was Russia in 1992. Anyway, you know, like it's probably not great to like unknowingly have nuclear weapons, but maybe that's the position that Japan has been pushed into, you know?
Right. Ooh, good stuff. Love it.
What a movie, man. I love it.
Right. And then you have laser pew pew battles and androids running around and oh God, there's just so much packed into this movie. And it's only an hour and 40 something minutes.
Yeah, you mentioned the android running around. Like, there's even a car chase in this movie where, like, the car chase turns into like the android like running faster than a vehicle. And then there's this like amazing stunt where the android tries to like fight. I think it's Emmy who's in like the other car. So like the Android M11 and Emmy are fighting each other. Like while clearly these vehicles are moving at like very high speeds, it's like a level of like action choreography that you usually don't see in Godzilla movies. It's really exciting and very, very well done, I think.
100%.
You know, now I won't belabor this too much, but you mentioned like the morality of like the Futurians, and like I think the Earth Union, which is like what like the organization of the future that the Futurians belong to, seems like it's meant to be a peacekeeping organization, but it uses very like destructive, violent tactics to like, you know, supposedly save the world from, you know, the evils of Japan or whatever. So like I think that just asked the question of like, can violence ever be like a valid tactic for like people that are trying to resist the tides of violence and like hegemony, destruction? You know, like is violence sort of resistance ever like a worthwhile tactic for people that are supposedly progressive and like, you know, anti-fascist, not to connect it to our current, you know, political state too much or whatever, but just like, you know, like I always find that topic really fascinating because once peaceful activism and resistance is exhausted and doesn't seem to make a difference, do violent tactics then become like a viable course of action? I don't think they ever do. I think they, you know, that's my perspective. And like in reading about this throughout, in like, you know, numerous different countries throughout world history, like it's never really worked. Like it kind of just leads to more violent retribution and like a greater kind of plague of violence, you know? But I think like the theoretical question, can you like cause destruction in order to avoid further destruction? We already kind of talked about this a little bit, but I just think it's such a fascinating political question.
It made me think about, I'm going to say this real quick. In the sequel to Planet of the Apes, beneath the Planet of the Apes, there are a race of human beings who have been living underground, unbeknownst to the apes above ground. And these human beings preach nonviolence. However, they have developed telekinesis, and they are able to mind control their enemies, apes or Charlton Heston, into killing each other. So these humans say, we're not killing people. We're peaceful. It's they who kill each other. And it's like that, that's a lot of BS. You're making it happen.
Yeah, that's a perfect connection. And it makes me very excited to bring some Planet of the Apes movies to the podcast because I would love to talk about that.
I think it's like the third or fourth episode now of Camp Kaiju where I've talked about Planet of the Apes.
It's a sign. Let's say, you know, let's bring the series to the pod.
All right, we'll get political there for sure. So for now, how about form and aesthetic?
Yeah, I think this movie's extremely well made. It's very, very well shot. There's like a lot of background action going on in various parts of the movie. Early on, when Terasawa meets up with Shindo and they're in like a little kind of restaurant, so sort of like a street stall kind of thing, there's like so much background action going on. There's like somebody else in like a distant stall that's like cleaning up, and then there's a lot of people biking by in the middle ground. It just is a great way to like make sure that something visually interesting is always happening in the frame. I think the flashbacks to 1944 are another good example of that. There's like an incredible, really fast track in, like where the camera just like zooms into like the Japanese base. It's really exciting. I love that shot. And the set itself, the set design is looks really, really amazing. And the special effects, I guess we should talk about the special effects too.
I think the special effects are really good. That's not a specific critique, but it's just true. I think King Ghidorah generally looks better than he's ever looked before. There are some stilted, weird, stiff shots of King Ghidorah flying around. But otherwise, he and Godzilla's so expressive with the animatronics in the eyes and the mouth. A lot of good, I don't know, is it matte work? There's like a lot of the Godzilla dinosaur is shot so effectively, I think, with the human beings running around its feet.
No, totally. Yeah, you're right. That scene in particular, like, I think there's a combination of like rear projection where, you know, like they shoot the actors and then like they shoot the Godzilla like suit or whatever in like a different shot, and then they just like composite the two images or whatever.
Composite, that's the word.
Yeah, but I think the technology had, of course, advanced a lot over the last like 20 or 30 years, so it looks fantastic here. And I think like the way that they blend that with like very large scale like suit work and like puppetry basically, it's pretty seamless. Like maybe there are a couple shots that are a little bit cheesy, like the part where like a big dinosaur foot like crushes some of the American sailors is not very convincing. But for the most part, the special effects by Koichi Kawakita are really, really, really well done in this movie. Very exciting. And you're right that like both Ghidorah and Godzilla are very expressive. And I love the fact that like the first image we see is Ghidorah's body on the ocean floor. And then the last image we see is Godzilla, like also underwater with a lot of like bubbles coming up and like sort of obscuring its face or whatever. Perfect bookends to like begin and end the movie.
And you know what also stands out to me is the, I guess, CGI in the film. There's a lot of computer graphic effects with the teleportation and the UFO. And I'm like, this holds up. This is super early for computer generated imagery. And yet it works. It doesn't look super, it doesn't look cheesy or muddled or anything.
Totally agree. There's like a time travel sequence, which is sort of like 2001: A Space Odyssey, but like a condensed version of that, like the wormhole sequence or whatever. Similar like psychedelic effects where it's all like trippy and like all these different colors and like weird shapes flying at the screen. It works really well here. It's very, very well done.
And this is such, like, this is such a great science fiction movie. And I mean, you're thinking about the United States at this time. I guess Jurassic Park is science fiction, but not like in the same way with aliens or time travel. So I don't know a good comparison in the States at this time, because I think this is one of the best science fiction movies I've ever seen.
I would agree with that. I think it's a good point. You know, we talked about Stargate, the movie, in our last episode, and I like that kind of comes to mind. That was in 1994. But I mean, the special effects in that are pretty cheesy, so maybe that's not really a good comparison. Terminator 2 probably is. Terminator, there's some good, you know, time travel stuff in there too. But yeah, there aren't really too many examples that are at the same level as this.
Independence Day with like the city destruction, cityscapes.
Yeah, definitely that one for sure. Maybe, you know, like Total Recall, RoboCop, stuff like that. There are some like really great like sci-fi special effects there. But you know, I think like the special effects here were done at like a fraction of the cost as like the effects in those movies. So
I'd put it in the same, I'd rank it as high as any of those films.
I mean, I really love this movie. Again, I'm sure that is so completely obvious by now, but like there's so much good to it. I think, like, not just the complexity of the movie's themes about Japan's social and political role in 1992, as well as in the history, as well as in its past and what it might be in the future. Like, it's not just complex, like, the way that the movie presents those ideas through time travel and UFOs and, like, androids and obviously Godzilla and King Ghidorah, like, movies that present really complicated social and political ideas through spectacular genres are like exactly my cup of tea. And this is one of the best examples of that I have ever seen. I know that sounds over the top, but I was like literally blown away by it and I did not expect any of that. So, yeah.
I'm telling you, it's this movie. It may have its detractors, but I think it is the perfect blend of fantasy and real complex socioeconomic, political, war themes. You're just like, what? There's so much going on in this. I love all those stakes. The Shindo character breaks my heart. And when Godzilla blows the head off of King Ghidorah, it is the most like fist pumping moment I've ever seen in a Godzilla movie. It's the best.
Yeah, absolutely. Like the destruction scenes towards the end are really fantastic. Like I know a lot of it is still like kind of model work or whatever, like the model buildings and like vehicles and stuff like that. But they had really like mastered that to a level where like every explosion and every sort of roar that the creatures make is like really just like hits you more than usual. It's great.
Yep. For the bad, I mean, the time travel stuff, I feel like it doesn't make sense, but it moves so fast that you just buy it. But I will say, I don't know, is this answered? Why don't the Futurians just go straight to 1944? Why do they stop in 1992?
I don't think that is answered. The very valid question. Not to mention, like, So, you know, like they're trying to like remove Godzilla from history, but then like one of the Futurians even says like, we knew that like Godzilla would be affected anyway. Like we knew that he would be resurrected. And it's like, well, this whole plot doesn't make sense then. Like, yeah, I mean, like with so many time travel movies, like it is really preposterous and there are so many plot holes and illogicalities. But you're right that it moves so fast. Like you're just like, all right, I guess I'm along for the ride. Whatever this movie does, I'm with it, you know?
Yeah. And also, I have some other things in the campy, but I'm gonna put the Spielberg line in the bad because it's just too much. It's a little too on the nose.
I mean, I assume that's like an homage to Spielberg in a way to sort of like pay tribute to like American sort of adventure and sci-fi and fantasy
Yeah.
movies. So that's cool. But like, yeah, it's too much. It's too on the nose. You're right. I noticed that like one of the Japanese soldiers is named Kurosawa too. So I think there are a lot of like film director references in the movie, but I could have done without them for sure.
Major Spielberg. Like, okay. All right,
Yeah, too much.
about you? Anything bad?
You know, even though this movie is only an hour and 45 minutes or so, it feels a lot longer than that. Like I think the plot is just so overstuffed. It does move quickly, so I'm grateful for that, and it's entertaining the whole time. But by the time it's over, you're like, man, did like 3 hours just go by? Like it seems like a long movie, not totally in a bad way, but it is kind of exhausting by the end of it.
Yeah, that's true. Just exhausting by sheer nature of content. How about campy?
I don't think it's really the fault of like the filmmakers. It's pretty much just the English post-dubbing. You know, I mean, I don't, it seems like they try to make it as silly as possible, and I don't know why they would do that for like such a very good, very well-made, complicated movie. But there are just so many examples of like really ridiculous, preposterous lines. Like I brought up the two before that the American GIs say. There's also the part where Terazawa, like, throws a bomb into like the computer mainframe or whatever, and he's like, go ahead, make my day. And then like the computer mainframe explodes. Like it's fun and entertaining, but it's like we don't really need that. This movie's already so wild and like entertaining. Like moments like that are probably a little bit like they detract from like the quality of the movie a little bit, you know?
Right. I just couldn't get over how dorky the Futurians look.
Yeah.
The white ones, they don't look like time travelers. They look like the guys in IT or HR who don't see the light of day. Just so funny.
No, you're totally right. Like it seems like they were just like the first two American actors that they could find. They were like, "Hey, come be in this movie." Like, yeah, it's they do not fit the role at all.
They're funny though.
Yeah, for sure. Like the M11 character wears that like ridiculous like puffy vest or whatever, you know? Not what I would expect an android to look like.
That's all I got for this movie. I'm ready to rate it if you are.
Yeah, I'm ready too.
Cool. Take us away.
All right, so here on Camp Kaiju, we have four ratings. Number one, it's a timeless classic and definitely stands the test of time. Number two, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and stands the test of time. Number three, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And number four, it is not worth revisiting and definitely does not stand the test of time.
Okay, in a total 360 from Wolf, I'm giving this timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time for effectively digging into all those complicated themes of war and Japan's relationship with Godzilla, while also being an incredible science fiction romp with robots and time travel. You name it, it has it, but somehow it works.
I could not agree more with everything you just said. For me, this is a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. For a movie so entertaining and fast-paced and just like wild and unpredictable, to also ask questions about like the responsibility that nations have on like the global economic and military scale, the actions of a country's past kind of influencing the future and kind of dictating the path that that country will take. These are really like complicated, ambitious, heady themes that are presented in such an entertaining, visceral way. This is one of my three favorite kaiju movies that I've ever seen. Can't wait to watch more Heisei-era movies like it.
Oh man, wait until you get to Godzilla versus Space Godzilla. You might give it a different rating, but hey, maybe you'll love it.
I can only assume that all the other Heisei movies will be as good as this one, but perhaps I will be disappointed.
That's good. I love them though. Yeah, I'm a Heisei fan. I love all of them.
I can't wait. I was really blown away by this movie, so yeah, excited for more.
All right. Well, let's get the blob back on here soon. For real next time, so he can stop beating down my door. Until next time, thank you all for hanging out. If you liked what you heard, please tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and visit CampKaijuMovieReviews.com, Instagram, or Patreon.com/CampKaiju for more monster movie content. We can't thank you enough. And before I forget, Camp Kaiju is sponsored by BanditsEmporium.com, where you can shop exclusive monster-inspired t-shirts with part of the proceeds supporting this show. BanditsEmporium.com, hit the link in our bio. As they say, we sell shirts. And as Camp Kaiju says, thanks again, friends. Until next time, stay campy.
Got him! Take that, you dinosaur!
Okay, move out, spread out, spread out all around him. He might still be alive.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Watch it, boys.
Not too close.
Yeah.